Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Erasmus of Rotterdam is probably a name that you know. In the 16th century, he was about as famous as anybody could be, a sort of intellectual hero, like today's guest has suggested, Albert Einstein or Stephen Hawking. It's rather amazing he became so. Born the illegitimate son of a priest, Erasmus did not have the greatest of starts in life, but hard work and natural brilliance made him one of the greatest scholars of his age. As such, he offered something radical, a vision of a humanist philosophy of Christ. He was critical of hypocrisy, but shamelessly in search of fame. He believed in independence, but sought the attention of the rich and powerful. And he practiced a spirit of constructive debate and tolerance from which we could learn, but he was anti-Semitic. In other words, he certainly had his flaws, but he was a gifted writer, ironic, playful, and intelligent. He was perhaps the first public intellectual of the modern age. He called to scholars to perform the sort of scholarship that contributed to the public good. Like anyone who rises high, Erasmus gathered many critics and enemies. To Martin Luther's mind, he did not go far enough. To Roman Catholic scholars, he was heretical. Erasmus lived in a transitional era. As himself a transformative and quintessential figure, he gives us a window onto his times. Today I welcome onto the podcast Professor William Barker, Ingalls Professor and former President of the University of King's College and Emeritus Professor of English at Dalhousie University. Professor Barker has taken Erasmus's enormous oeuvre and long life and packed both into a wonderfully entertaining and succinct book in Reaction Books series on Renaissance lives, Erasmus of Rotterdam, The Spirit of a Scholar. It's the first English language biography of Erasmus in 30 years. Welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
Thank you very much.
It is a real pleasure to have you here to talk about one of the most famous and important people of the early modern period, and one whose name I think many people will know, but they perhaps might not know that much more. And also because you have written this wonderful little book about Erasmus that seems to me to embody precisely what Erasmus cared about, which is writing in excellent prose for the public, something which serves up the ideas of scholarship. So this is a real joy to read your book.
It was an interesting project to try to do. Erasmus is like trying to drink from a fire hose. There's an incredible amount of material to look at and to read about. And then when you've read about him, you read about all the people he knew, which is quite a massive task.
Yes. So just, and I ask this as a writer myself, how did you go about distilling all of that into something which in the end is relatively slim volume?
A page a day. Because there was so much to find out about each thing. So I knew how to break it down when I started, because I decided I would just go chronologically through his life. But then it was really bit by bit, and then rewriting when I finally had a complete story there. So I saw his life in three parts, really, and it breaks down quite well that way. But by the time you get to the third part, there's so many things happening. You lose track of the chronology because there are six or seven different stories all happening at the same time, because he was involved in so many controversies and debates and so on. And to try and follow the streams of that is difficult.
Well, let's think about him following that tripartite structure then, your first part is preparation. And this takes us through his formative years up until the age of 34. What did Erasmus want us to know of that period?
Yes, it is what Erasmus wanted us to know, is what we know. Because he rewrote his own biography several times in order to get himself released from his monastic obligations. By the end of that period, he had left. That takes him up to really 1499 is really the transition point in his life. And up until then, he's no one of interest, really, except for a very small number of people who happened to be interested in him as a scholar, because he was a very talented student. But he came from an illegitimate son of a priest, and that meant every time he wanted to do anything in the church, he had to get special dispensation in the end from the Pope to hold property, to dress as a secular priest instead of as a member of this Augustinian canon regular he was, and to move out of that and not have to report in regularly as he had to do in the early years back to superior to tell him what he was up to. He lived like a Netherlandish priest at the time, or Low Countries priest, and Brabant was his area. And then it was only when he got to England that he suddenly began to travel in a different circle. And that was really a life changer for him, I think. And even though he'd been in Paris and studied at the university there, he really detested the kind of things he had to study, which is scholastic philosophy. And he was kind of a dropout, hanger-on kind of grad student, tutoring people for a number of years and writing little textbooks for them, which later on turned into big textbooks because he had a tendency all his career to expand everything that he did. He'd write a small book, then it would expand it, and it would get bigger and bigger until it was multi-volume sometimes.
And I hadn't realized before I read your book that it's because of his illegitimate birth that he really only had the one name. I mean, he's like Madonna, isn't he? He was Erasmus.
Yes, he was Erasmus, and he had a father with a regular name, but he dropped that and kept to the Erasmus. And then Erasmus chose the Desiderius. The Erasmus is a kind of Greek form, and then he chose a more Latin form of that. And then he added, quite late on, actually, after this English period, the of Rotterdam. And that's really the only way we know he was born in Rotterdam, because he grew up in Gouda, which is south of Rotterdam, and that's what we have records of. And we know he went to school in Gouda and in Deventer, and that he was sent to Sertogenbosch, a small town where Bosch, the painter, came from also, or lived in. And there he had a very unpleasant schooling experience, too. So he ended up really hating school and university, and yet he became the leading scholar of his time.
It is an interesting paradox that he is just about always seeking to escape from whatever kind of clerical or monastic commitments he has, and he doesn't take up a position in the academy, and yet a career in the church or in the university is the obvious place for a man of his mind and his qualities.
Yeah, he taught at Cambridge, but he had never had an official university position. He taught in Louvain for a number of years, the College of Three Languages that a friend of his founded. I never really had a very good relationship with that university. They allowed him to be there as a member, but he never turned into a professor, really, of any kind. He was just doing his own work most of that time, and then would teach a bit on the side.
And you mentioned his antipathy towards scholastic philosophy in Paris. Could we briefly gloss what we mean by scholastic philosophy and the sort of humanism that Erasmus develops? I mean, would it be fair to say that for Erasmus, it was about scholarship that was for the public good that counted?
Yeah, it was what drove him. He was very attracted early on to the classical writers. He was supposed to have known Horace all by heart quite early on, and Terence, playwright. And so he really loved that kind of writing. And he found that in the scholastic philosophy, where you're really trying to work through very close arguments on the meanings of words and definitions and so on of particular things, like what is a soul, exactly what are its limits and so on. And the methods are taken from Aristotle and from a whole tradition that follows that. And he realized that there were good philosophers, for instance, someone like Aquinas. He accepted Aquinas as being a great philosopher, but that's not what he felt people like him really wanted to read or hear about. And so what you had is people coming from that training going into churches and giving sermons to people based on these sort of very detailed examinations of particular issues, questions that might come up of ethical types or whatever, and solved using syllogisms and things like that. And he was much more interested in storytelling and in metaphor, in the language of the classical writers were using to explain ethical behavior. So often in a writer like Plutarch, there are exemplifies people. They show you how people do things by their deeds and by their actions and so on. And the poetry tells you things metaphorically. And that, he felt, is a much more direct form of communication with people. And that, of course, turned into his total commitment to the New Testament, where he felt that people were getting the word of Christ filtered through a kind of scholastic lens. And for him, Jesus was a storyteller, an ethical leader as well, and someone who was clear and used parables to explain things. And so that kind of language was much more acceptable. And that's why he ended up doing the edition of the New Testament. He did that in 1516 and kept revising it. And also rewrote the Bible into a series of paraphrases. And the paraphrases, they were translated in English and then placed in all the English churches. Every church had to have Erasmus's paraphrases because those were seen as a simple, clear guide and entry point into religion rather than the sort of more scholastic and detailed approach that was taken in the late medievals.
One of the things that emerges as being central to the humanist program, and indeed the first of his proverbs and his adages reflects this, is friendship. He has this network of intellectuals who will form a kind of community around him. And this is absolutely vital for him, especially, as you've mentioned, his friends in England. Can you tell us a bit about that community and those friends and what difference that made?
The friendship thing goes quite far back in his own writing career. And he's really piggybacking on something that had started in Italy, which was this idea of a republic of letters, a kind of way of exchanging information and stories and letters amongst a group of people who are equally educated and who like to talk about what they do. And some of that turned into learned society. Some of it just stayed as correspondence, as in Erasmus's case. And these friends are an interesting feature because, in a way, some of them aren't that close to him, but they're called a friend. And then others really are. So someone like Thomas More in England, who he got to know when he first went to England in 1499, he got to know More quite well, and they became quite close. And they did translations together for the fun of it, you know, spent a fun evening together translating Lucian from the Greek and setting each other little competitions and things like that. And then afterwards, writing letters very often back and forth to each other. And this combination, Erasmus actually liked to show to people. So he began to publish his letters just about the same time he published the New Testament and showing people what this community looked like, this republic of letters that he was in. And people got excited by this, and even monarchs, popes, and so on all wanted to belong. So you have this kind of quality where this learning seems to have attracted people to it. And it was not the regular church learning. It was something else, really a kind of ethical model of living and a certain style that people picked up from the ancients, really from ancient Rome. And so this began to form groups of people. And these friends were friends in England. They were friends that people he met, scholars. So when he went to England the first time, More, and John Collett was another one who he was extremely close to and who also went into debates with him, biblical subjects. And so their communication with each other and the kind of model of learning and exchange that went on, that became a model for people. And then it spread wider. And in Erasmus's case, several visits to England, and then he ended up teaching at Cambridge in 1511 to 1514. He really got to know a lot of people that way, and letters were exchanged, ideas, things like that. And then you get this kind of jokey kind of thing, lovely letters about gifts from people and exchanges and so on. There's a wonderful exchange that he and a friend, an Italian who lived in London, Ammonio, and he got together, and they were boasting each other how much they could praise each other over these exchanges of kegs of wine that Ammonio was sending them and compliments they could give each other. So there was this whole mutual admiration society that got going. It really spread until finally there were people in Poland who were participating, people in Italy, people in Spain, France, England, in the Netherlands, Low Countries, I guess you'd call it. So you had all of these people interchanging letters, and Erasmus was the center of a lot of this. In France, writer Guillaume Budet, who we got into correspondence with, extremely learned Greek scholar, who preferred to write, if he could, his letters in Greek rather than just ordinary Latin. They got in this weird relationship where they would be complimenting each other and meanwhile correcting each other's prose or indicating scholarly errors that they'd made. So it was like a privilege almost to be corrected by each other. So it was an odd kind of thing, but it still exists, I think, in some scholarly communities. You go to a conference and people will compliment you at the same time they're correcting you, and then you're supposed to be so happy to be corrected by them, that kind of thing.
Yes, this is one for the academics listening, that moment where someone says, it's more of a comment, really. Anyway, so after his first visit to England, it's striking that he gets robbed as he sees it at the border, and necessity becomes the sort of mother of invention. Poverty breeds creativity, he really starts to write. And what I was struck by is reading your work, which puts it chronologically, is just the variety of what he's turning his mind to as he starts out to write, whether it's thinking about Proverbs or Cicero or the Handbook of a Christian Soldier.
I think when he was in England, he realized, I'm a person of interest. I don't think he knew that before. He was striving to be one, but suddenly he was in a community that had already formed. It was small, but they had Lineker, who was a Greek scholar who'd studied under Poliziano in Italy and William Grolson and others. And they had Collett and Moore. And these people were all part of a level of society, this kind of bureaucratic culture that were in the courts now and in the churches. They were excited by classical learning. And I think that he had already done a lot of this training stuff with the students. So he'd written all these little textbooks, I guess you could say, just little trials of textbooks. And then he began to write them. Someone found one of these textbooks he did when he was a tutor in Paris and published it without his permission. So then he had to rewrite it, make it better. And it was this kind of thing that was going on. And it was no copyright whatsoever. Outside of the Holy Roman Empire might have a certain kind of copyright or so on. But basically, it was pretty loose. And so people were just publishing his stuff all over the place after a while. But in the early books, he really focused in on the things that he knew about, which was a Christian life, which he had been through in the monasteries, and then his own discovery of literary style and his need to teach it. So learning about Proverbs and putting these little gems in your writing were an essential part of what he was trying to do. But now he was doing it not in a classroom, but in a public sphere. And I think that's the big thing that he discovered, is that he could actually succeed by being more public and not trying to do things as privately as he'd been doing it before. And it was the printing press that allowed him to do that.
And the other thing that you suggest is a kind of turn, a moment of change for him, is his trip through the Alps to Italy. Is this the moment where he really starts to make his name?
He definitely is going through a bit of a midlife crisis when he's heading down. That was 1509, and he was very aware that he hadn't reached his potential. He was almost 40, but it was a career crisis for him. And I think that he was still a tutor. He was taking these two boys to Italy who were of Italian background, but they needed to see the homeland. And then he stayed in various locations, and then he realized that he was now, when he met all these Italian scholars, he was actually operating at the same level they were. And it really showed when he ended up in Venice working with the publisher Aldus Manutius in Venice and worked on his adages there. And I think at that stage he knew he was on a roll and he was moving. And people there could see it, he could sense it, and the work that emerged was the one that really made his reputation, which is the Book of Adages. Because he took the little book that he'd published sometime earlier and expanded it into a full-size telephone book-style collection of adages, which was quite massive and which showed enormous learning. Because basically, he had read everything in classical literature that he could, and looking for proverbs wherever he could find them, and then was able to weave these proverbs into stories about how they came into being and how they were used by early scholars, and then the special treat is how to use them yourself. And the special add-on was, he showed you how to do it by doing it himself. So in the adages, there are many proverbs used to describe other proverbs. That's where his real skill as a writer came out, is being able to adapt these different genres to this kind of desire he had to really actually connect with the reader.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
After this is his most radical work to date at that point, The Praise of Folly. What was this and why was it such a hit?
Praise of Folly started as an amusing little attempt when he was leaving Italy. 1509, he headed back to England and he was coming back through the Alps and it was on a horseback and he suddenly had this idea, or so he says, of writing this amusing joke. Really, an extended joke for his friend Thomas More, who enjoyed jokes. And this was going to be a speech in praise of folly. And it was based on an earlier classical form. There were people who'd written things on the praise of baldness and the praise of flies and the praise of things, upside down praises, praises where you wouldn't expect to see them. And folly was thus taken to an extreme. And in this book, he really showed his satirical side that he hadn't shown before in his writing. And there he begins to make his social commentary on things that he sees around him and comments on greedy monks and prelates and warlike leaders who basically aren't paying any attention to their people at all. And then people who have terrible social behavior and so on. And it turns out there are a lot of fools out there. And then it gets turned inward into, let's look more carefully at this idea of fool and the way it's used, for instance, in the Bible, in Ecclesiastes or in St. Paul. And St. Paul refers to himself as a fool in places. And so what does that mean? And it may mean the most foolish thing you can be to a foolish person is a Christian, a truly proper behaving Christian. And this would work quite well for us now in our secular era, because anyone who is like a real believer in religion or something is seen as slightly crazed or slightly not all there. And yet his argument is, in a sense, they aren't, because they have moved outside the normal social mold of how to behave. And the normal social mold is actually foolishness. And so it's a kind of a double thing that's happening by the end. It gets quite complicated at the end. And so everyone is foolish, everyone. And it's an argument that it's hard to talk your way out of. And Folly, who is a female character in the thing, is freely naming everyone insight to be a fool. And the book, I think Erasmus, by the end, it almost turned into a kind of meditation on the nature of being Christian and all that. And I think it went further than Erasmus had planned. And I do believe it's one of those books that people now and then write, they didn't know that they had it in them to write it. And this is what came out. And later on, I don't think he considered it to be one of his best books, but everyone else did. It's a hard book for modern readers to read at the beginning, but once you get the hang of it, it's pretty good. It's good to read it with notes at the bottom, because all that learning that he'd taken in Italy, all the adages that he learned are just poured into this book. So it was also seen to be as extremely learned by people and therefore something of real interest.
So I'm getting a sense that there was a kind of delight among scholars at the time in spotting, oh, that's good, you've used that from, oh, Virgil there, and oh, you've, oh, that bit from Cicero there. You know, there's the kind of sense of enjoying recognising the inclusions and thinking of that as cleverness. But there's a kind of inversion going on here, which is where he's doing something frightfully clever and full of classical allusion and demonstrating all this learning, but actually he's talking about the value of being a fool. And perhaps it's that paradoxical nature that makes it so appealing.
It is as paradoxical as one could achieve, I think, in taking on something like that. It was published with one of the early editions with the In Praise of Baldness. Someone tossed an edition of that in by Synesthesius, I think his name was. And so it's popped into there and other of these false praises. It was a kind of a jokey thing, but it's that learning that really mattered and that people were super responsive to. And the way he was able to use his own learning in the work, too. And he refers to it himself. He said, if you want more, He ended up writing footnotes to it and provided an index to it in case you needed that also. So as it went through subsequent publications, you have this commentary written by a younger scholar, but mostly by Erasmus, actually. And it tells you, oh, for this, you should read Erasmus's Adages. It turns in on itself and feeds off itself, the whole project.
You've mentioned already his New Testament, which is a few years later, 1516. If the Praise that Follows has been universally sort of acclaimed, how controversial was his New Testament?
Oh, I think pretty controversial. It was not a project that was a novelty, because in Spain, scholars were already working on a massive multilingual version of the Bible, the Complutensian Polyglot, it's called. And it was going to be a Bible with different languages set side by side, like an expanded Loeb translation of something. We have all the languages now and different versions. But he got started on this. And what really got him moving was he's always been interested in what to do with the Bible and how to approach it. But he really had trained himself now as a philological scholar. He's interested in words, where they came from, what's appropriate at a certain place and time, what were the actual meanings of things. And he came across the work of a scholar named Lorenzo Valla, who he'd already known for his work on Latin style. And Valla had done a really close analysis of the standard Vulgate Bible that was being circulated at the time and pointed out many mistranslations between the Greek version of the Bible and of the New Testament and the extant Latin version. And that got Erasmus very heated up over this particular project. And so he was able to go back, look at the Bible and the way the language has been translated, and then do his own translation. And that is a step too far for his people around him in the church and so on. And it was seen as being verging on heretical. When you get people translating Bibles, people do get upset and they prefer to go back to the one that they know. It had a lot of problems. And also, when the first edition came out, it had many errors in it, because Erasmus was an extremely fast worker. And I think he'd figured out already by then that you can publish something, but there's a great thing. You can republish it. And so the Bible went through 5 editions. The commentary kept getting expanded on it. And in the commentary, he was then able to write against the critics of his Bible, and who would maybe criticize something that he said. And then he would go in a footnote to the commentary, his annotations to the Bible, and slam the critic who had attacked him. And so it actually makes for quite interesting reading, a biblical commentary, because it's a bit like reading Freud. A lot of Freud's writings are really attacks on his attackers. And Erasmus is doing that in his work too. So it made for a dynamic reading experience. It was a live issue that you were looking at. It was something that was meaningful and that was being fought over. And so people would look at this and they would have to make up their own minds too as they were reading it. This Bible project, that combined with Praise of Folly, which was seen as being heretical in its own way, really got him to be a figure of great annoyance to scholars and theologians in different places, Paris especially, and in places in Spain and so on. And then it's really just after this period that you begin to have his many critics just coming after him. I try to explain that in the book, because there is a kind of theory that a sociologist sets up, which is there's only so much room at the top. And when you have a period of controversy, as it soon became in 1517 with Luther, a highly controverted period, there would be a necessity for someone to be standing out in front, to take the discussion, to lead the discussion and so on. And Erasmus was one of those people, or became the person really for quite a period of time. I think towards the end of his life, people dropped away from him a bit. He was too complicated for them by the end. But with the Bible and all these many classical things that he'd been doing, it really had attracted quite an interest in him and following.
So you mentioned that this is a period where there's many critics and there are debates over all sorts of things. But perhaps the most important is Martin Luther, you've just mentioned. And, you know, at the outset, at a glance, you'd think they'd have so much in common. I know they never met, but you'd think, well, they both cared about reform. They're both quite earthy and a bit concerned with bodily functions. And they're both interested in new readings of scripture. So why, in the end, do they not see eye to eye?
There was two things happening, I think, for Erasmus. One was the environment around Luther, or of the whole religious debate, and his feeling forced into a head-on debate with Luther. Because two things were happening with that. First of all, it was not just Luther, but it was the whole humanist project, which was under scrutiny now by theologians and so on, because they saw Luther as being more of a humanist than a regular Catholic, even though he was highly trained in scholastic philosophy. And people were taking sides, and everyone on the humanist side was urging Erasmus to fight with Luther, because Luther was seen to attract the hatred of this anti-humanist crowd of theologians and so on. He was pulled into it. Initially, he didn't really want to do that. He actually admired aspects of Luther, but he felt Luther was pushing it too hard. And Luther, I think, also changed a lot from 1517 up into the 1520s. And in 1520, he was excommunicated. So during this short period, Luther, I don't think, even knew what he had started until it got out of control. And he was being forced into looking at his own position and clarifying it further and further. And finally, really, to the point of a break with the church. And I don't think he necessarily intended that at the beginning. And Erasmus was with him along that road for quite a while. And then suddenly realized this has gone too far. And the curious thing about the book that Erasmus wrote, the Diatribe about free will, is that he really latched onto the one thing that Luther had not really foregrounded, but in discussion with Erasmus, it turned out that was actually the make or break issue. It wasn't corruption in the church or church indulgences or hatred of the humanist study and all that kind of stuff. It was really something to do that was an essential thing in what Luther was on about. And that is the denial of free will and agency in your moral life, really. And Erasmus tried to explain his position on that, and Luther was having none of it. Luther had a very extreme position. Erasmus just couldn't go down that road, but they had a lot in common up until the real break came.
I wonder if another sort of point of controversy was that Erasmus couldn't accept the principle that only scripture is the source of authority, in part because he could see how flawed translations of it could be.
Yes, that's a very good observation. Erasmus was very aware of the tradition of interpretation and could see that anyone who locked into something was going into a world that was already extremely controversial right from the very earliest days of the church. And he had been editing a lot of these texts now, the early church fathers, doctors, and so on. Really, he could see how difficult it was to reach some kind of an agreement or consensus. But he felt that in the church, as a community of friends, you could say, there should be some form of consensus in there. And he could not find that consensus with Luther. And that consensus came of a long tradition of reading, thinking, meditating on scripture and so on. And Luther had broken from that. And also the other thing is, Luther was supposed to be a friend. That's how they had initially approached each other and the possibility of some kind of friendship. It was an extremely unfriendly exchange that had occurred. And that notion of the community and of the consensus of the Republic of Letters, people joining together to create overall a better civic society. He could see that was collapsing with Luther, and Luther could see that he could not belong to this group or to this idea of a group, I guess would be more accurate.
When we look at Erasmus, there's actually much that is familiar in terms of fame today. He's famous in part because he seeks fame, like he's on social media or something. He does have the media of the time, which is print, that he is using so effectively. And you quote Andrew Pettigrew saying that he was a truly commercial intellectual, and one has to admit, if you're going to publish and republish, yeah, so people have got to get your later editions, that is pretty savvy. What do you think we should learn from him?
I am quite drawn to his message. I'm not sure if I'm at the end of the humanist, or you yourself at the end of a humanist tradition or not, because things have changed a lot in the academic world and in the idea of what the canon of literature and all that. It's undergoing a tremendous changes in our own time. And to look back at Erasmus's time, which was also full of surprises and changes there, that he had set on a path that I felt really regulated a lot of education in times after. So It really, in England, it could be seen in St. Paul's School, 1509. John Collett rewrote the rules for the school and changed the curriculum, and it had a huge impact in England. And really, the whole education of England up in the time of Shakespeare and so on, Marlowe, and they're all reasonably well educated, even though Shakespeare had small Latin and less Greek. He was expected to have some of them. And he was writing in part for a learned audience as well as for the more popular audience. And we have kept that in the education system for many centuries, really. And people like Boris Johnson reciting large swaths of the Iliad is on a video somewhere. And I like, wow, that would have been a good party trick in Erasmus's time, not ours. So that was retained in the school system and all that. And now I think we see a shift away from certainly historical studies, classical literature and so on. And it's other things are happening. And so my takeaway from this is that if we do that, we're losing something. And that is the thing that Erasmus really had, is this personal sense of showing oneself in one's own writing, the interiority of each individual as a response to that interior reaction we have, which makes us each an individual as readers. Each reader is different from each other reader. That's why we get so many debates about what something actually means. And he encourages that. And he also encourages a discussion that goes around that, and that the ideas can come into discussion and play. And at the same time, that serves to support the project of a kind of civic society. So we're in something that's sort of putting that a little bit under stress right now. So I'm not sure if I look back to him as an exemplar of something that was great, or maybe that's something that should be great ahead of us.
Well, thank you very much for a brief introduction to this great figure, Erasmus. But I do heartily recommend to listeners this lovely little book, Erasmus of Rotterdam, The Spirit of a Scholar. Professor Barker, thank you so much for your time.
And thank you very much. I enjoyed that.
Thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher Alice Smith and my producer Rob Weinberg. We are always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at notjusttudors. And please remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released. History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.